Welcome to the Brighton Book Club, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. On the show this month, we speak to local author Jane Crittenden about her new romance novel, Summer Ever After, to Brighton newbie Jill Johnson about the second book in her Eustacia Rose crime series, Hell's Bells. We also speak to Brighton legend Aflo the Poet about their involvement in this year's The Coasters Queer Festival. Brighton and Hove's Festival of LGBTQ plus writing is back and running from the 10th to the 13th of October 2024. It is 3 days of lively conversations, panels, workshops, performances and films celebrating some of the best and brightest LGBTQ plus writers at ACCA on the Sussex campus. Aflo talks about Brighton's changing poetry scene, the writers that inspired them and what they wanted to bring to this year's festival as part of the steering group. Aflo will be hosting the open mic event on Friday the 10th of October at 7 p.m. called Poetics, Politics and Pleasure, which will feature some incredible poets and also give you the chance to read your work at the open mic. If reading your poems at an open mic seems as terrifying to you as it does to me, Aflo offers their tips for challenging your nerves. If you haven't already seen, we have teamed up with the Coasters Queer Festival to release a limited series of podcasts showcasing events from 2023's festival. Head over to our Instagram page at BTM Book Club to find out more and search for the Brighton Book Club wherever you get your podcasts. And if you use the code PODCAST20, you can get 20% off the price of all your tickets and festival passes to the Coasters Queer. Make sure you're signed up to their mailing list to hear first about events and workshops. Whew, that was a long intro, and I'm sure you're desperate to get into the show, and I hope you enjoy it. Can love bloom again under the heat of the Spanish sun? 10 years ago, while travelling, before starting a cookery apprenticeship, Alice fell head over heels for the food, the sun, and the gorgeous Andy Hall. Family tragedy sent her back to London, but now, finally, she's been given the chance to return. Only to find herself working alongside none other than Andy, the only man to ever break her heart. The decade apart has changed them both, though he still has his frustratingly good looks. And is Alice imagining, or just the spark that always existed between them still burn just as brightly? Not ready to risk getting hurt again, she focuses on exploring the culinary delights of the city and begins to remember a life she once dreamed of. As Alice rediscovers a world of possibilities under the hot Spanish sun, could there be a second chance for Andy and the love they used to share? Perhaps the vibrant flavours of Barcelona might just be the ingredients for everlasting love. Jane Crittenden, welcome back to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here again.
Summer Ever After follows on from your debut novel out with Amazon Publishing called Worlds Apart. How was the process of writing the often dreaded second book?
Yeah, it was an interesting process, actually. I'd already started writing it when I got my book deal, and it was quite a different book from this one. I worked through it. I was still working through it. I then spent a bit of time working with my agent, and we worked on it together. And then when it went off to Lake Union, my publisher, they then came back with some comments, which were heftier than book one. But that, I think, is to be expected. Book one, when you get your debut novel taken up by a publisher, it's usually pretty polished. It's been through, you know, lots of different writing groups and workshopping and things like that. So I think a book two has less eyes on it. So it was tough, but I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the challenge of going through the edits. And at the end of it, I felt really proud of myself. The editor was really kind enough to say, you know, you've literally answered all the edits that we've asked, and it's absolutely fabulous, and I've got no other comments. So I was really pleased about that.
That is wonderful, and something that you don't often hear. So I'd love to know, Jane, what makes you gravitate towards writing books set abroad, and why Barcelona for Summer Ever After?
Yeah, I suppose Worlds Apart, my first book, was set in Auckland, and I lived there, and I really enjoyed the scene setting and writing a story just set somewhere else, just because it just gives it another flavour, what you see, what you smell, what you hear. And I don't know, a little bit of curiosity in somewhere perhaps not all readers have been to. And so with the second book, I was thinking, but that was my first thought, was not what's the story about, is where am I going to set it? I love holidays and traveling and that sort of thing. So Barcelona, I've been to quite a few times. I think I'm trying to remember how many. I think it's about five times. And the first time was interrailing, which is sort of actually where Alice and Andy meet. They meet on a train. And then the second time I went back, I lived there for a couple of months while I was learning to become a teacher of teaching English as a foreign language. So I had a very short stint living there, and but it was a long time ago in the late 90s. So yeah, and I've been back from holiday since. So yeah, the language school idea features in the book as well. So yeah, I guess taking inspiration from trips of my own.
Another thing that plays a big part in this book is food. Why did you
Yeah.
decide to have food as kind of a big character in the book?
Well, it kind of, I'll be honest, it didn't begin that way. I mean, there was an element of the cooking that was always there, the working in the restaurant, but that's what was really good about the editing process. The two editors that worked with me really wanted me to bring out the food aspect a lot more. And it was fun because I sort of, I'll be honest again, I'm not a foodie. I mean, I love food and restaurants, and I'm not even much of a cook. But I put myself in their shoes and I imagine what they'd be thinking. And so when I went back and did those edits, I really brought much more of the food aspect out. And yeah, it was fun to do actually. Yeah.
Can we hear an extract, please, Jane?
Yeah. So the book is written in two points of view. So Andy talks about, so Andy's section is 10 years ago, when they first meet, and Alice's sections are now. So I'm actually going to go straight to chapter three and read you an extract in Andy's point of view, 10 years ago. I wasn't supposed to be on a train to Barcelona or a train to anywhere. But there we were, Jimmy and I, making our way to Ibiza via my uncle's, just as my mum had wanted. We trudged onto the train and thrown ourselves across seating for four, hungover from our last night out in Montpellier with one of my brother's mates. Dave would take us on a bar crawl and paid for all the drinks. Generous. Though the drunker he became, the more desperate he was to thank me for helping his sister. And in the end, I had to tell him to stop. It was too much. We both knew there was much more lingering in the conversation than my heroics, and neither of us wanted to go there. I touched my Gemini pendant and stared up at the world gathering pace outside the window as the train pulled away. I wondered how quickly we'd get the fuck out of Barcelona without sending my mum into a spin. Not that I was a mummy's boy and did everything she asked. I was just trying to be a good son, though up until now I've made a total hash of it. Agreeing to stop off and see Uncle Enrique in Barcelona put me back in the good books. Shift over. A girl similar in age to us stood in the aisle grinning. Her blonde hair was shaved down one side and she had piercings in her lip and eyebrow. I'd lay a bet she had tattoos too, probably in places only the privileged would see. Charlie, Jimmy hollered, sitting up. Come on, move your asses. Charlie swung up her rucksack, narrowly avoiding knocking out the girl behind her. Careful, she muttered. She had amazing hair, thick and wavy, an olive skin that probably looked tanned all year round. Wary eyes flitted between Jimmy and me. I threw her a friendly grin and she responded with a watery smile. Charlie heaved her rucksack into her arms and tossed it onto the storage rack, causing her t-shirt to ride up. Jimmy lifted thick eyebrows and locked onto a bare, pierced midriff. He ran his hand over his buzz cut. You work out? He asked her. I could see where this might be heading. Charlie threw the other girl's bag up top with similar ease and then plopped down next to Jimmy. She flexed her biceps. They were impressive. Gym bunny, she said. She clocked her friend still hovering. Jesus, sis, sit down. Sister, my gaze hopped between them. Yes, I could see it now. The same broad heart-shaped face, generous mouth, and green eyes, and the dark-haired girls were a shade more grey. She glanced at me again, and I wondered idly if she liked blondes. Jimmy and I spent a week in Montpellier. My hair had gone lighter in the sun, and we slept off hangovers on the beach, so we both had half-decent tans. I swung my legs around and stood up. "Which seat would you like, madame?" I said, sweeping my arm out as though she was royalty. Sister girl rolled her eyes and sat down opposite Charlie. "And you know each other?" "How?" she said, looking at them both. A sister laughed, luminous eyes like a window to all the energy bubbling away inside her. Jimmy couldn't peel his gaze away. "When you're in the loo, I accosted this one on the platform," she replied, prodding him. "They're going to Barcelona. I thought it'd be fun if we travelled together." Charlie was sitting cross-legged now and close enough for Jimmy to soak up a full view of her cleavage. I turned my attention to sister girl. "Have you been away long?" I asked. "About a month," she replied, reaching through her bag. "How about you?" "We spent the last week at my brother's mate's house in Montpellier," I said. "We're stopping for my uncle's in Barcelona on the way to Ibiza." "Uh-huh," she said, and pulled out a pen and postcard. I caught sight of a sandy beach and turquoise sea before she flipped it over. "How long will you be there?" asked Charlie. "We're going to Narbonne first." "A few days, maybe." "His uncle's got a restaurant in Plaza Real with free digs upstairs," added Jimmy. "He said we can stay as long as we want. Except we need to get to Ibiza," I reminded him. "Oh yeah, why's that? What's the hurry?" said Charlie. "I'm DJing," I muttered. It wasn't strictly true, but close enough to the truth. For real, her eyes shone. Sister girl looked up from her postcard. "What kind of restaurant is it?" Charlie groaned. "Do not get her talking about food or cooking or restaurants, otherwise you will never get off this train." "Hey," she sounded indignant. "I didn't see you complaining in Amsterdam when you ate a whole bag of profiteroles in the market, or when you insisted on trying a million gelato flavors in that amazing ice cream place I found in Milan. You've been happy to stuff your gob wherever we've gone." Charlie sighed. "It's true, I'm going to be massive by the time I get home." She lifted her T-shirt and patted her tone bare stomach, causing Jimmy's eye to spring out on stalks. "So?" Sister girl was still watching me. Her steady gaze was unnerving and my mouth went dry. I was used to dating women more interested in taking selfies than making proper eye contact with me. Twisted my pendant. Spanish food? A smile twitched her mouth and she broke into a warm laugh. "I asked for that." "His mum wants us to stick around and help out in the restaurant," Jimmy continued. "No chance," I muttered. "Really? Why?" Sister girl looked amused. "No one refuses Sophia," Blabbermouth continued. "What was it she said? You are a disgrace if you think you can go to Ibiza without helping your uncle first." His Catalan accent was crap. He made me sound like a kid. I gave him the death stare and his laugh boomed out. "Sounds like she rules the roost," said sister girl, tapping her pen on the postcard. "I know how that feels. Mine's the same." She nudged me. "You should give it a go. You don't know what you're missing." I stretched out my legs and sighed. "Long hours, high pressure, stress, no thanks." I didn't need it. I've been there before.
Thank you so much. That was beautifully read and gave such a good flavour of the book. No pun intended. I'd love to know a bit about your actual writing process. So you've got dual point of view, and dual timeline. How does that look when you're writing it? Do you write kind of chronologically or character by character or time by time?
I do a bit of all of that, actually. So at the beginning, I do write past and present. For this book, I was writing past and present. And then I would go, no, I just need to write just the past. I think it's important to almost, for this book particularly, because it was all Andy, it was all in the past, and it was all Alice and all in the present. And they are almost like two stories. And I needed Andy's narrative arc and I needed Alice's narrative arc. So at the beginning, it was a bit interspersed. And then I realised I needed to just write just the past with Andy's point of view and then Alice's. And then that's when all the magic starts, because you can start weaving in all the little things. So the Gemini pendant necklace he's wearing in the past in chapter 3 is in one of the opening paragraphs of chapter 1 that Alice recalls. So it's all those little things that I really enjoy doing in the editing process.
Absolutely. What authors inspire you, Jane?
Oh, goodness. That's a difficult question. I read such a range. I like reading in my genre, which I know a lot of authors don't so much. So Rebecca Ryan writes some really fun rom-coms, and hers her characters are really lively, and they have some sort of the dialogue's great, so that's quite inspiring. I've recently read some of Fiona Collins' books. So hers are they're not the rom-com, they're much more romantic, but they one I read recently was over a long timeline, where the people meet very young and they don't get together till much later on in life. So I do think it's important to try and read in the genre so that you can sort of get an idea of what everybody else is doing. But I've also read Joe Furniss's Dead Ma recently, which is a completely different book. It's a crime book, and it's not something I'd normally read. And I really enjoyed that because it was just all about what was going on in a very small space, and that in itself is inspiring. And I'm sure reading those sorts of things, reading different types of writing, will help me for the next book.
What are your top tips for writing romance, Jane, for anyone that might be listening who's thinking about writing it themselves?
I think one of the right. So one of the hardest things about writing romance is you know there's going to be a happy ever after. And so it's all about the obstacles, it's all about the journey. Try and make sure that hook's really clear, even if you're not sure exactly what that hook is when you first start writing. Once you're finding your way into the story and you can really feel that hook, write it down on a piece of paper so that when you're going through your second, you're looking at that hook and making sure that is coming through all the time.
That is very good advice. Thank you very much. What is next for you, Jane? What are you working on?
So book three is set on a fictitious Croatian island off Hvar. I decided to, well, I think I didn't really want to write about somewhere I didn't know that well. I didn't want to sort of make any faux pas. And so to make the island fictitious but have a lot of references to I have been to Croatia a few times and loved it. And so, yeah, it references a lot of things that are like Hvar. So, but this makes it a little bit more my unique story. So, yeah, so that's where I'm at. I'm currently just writing my first draft.
Amazing. And I assume it's more romance.
More romance, yes. Yes. So, again, past and present. And actually, another second chance romance. I think I'm a bit addicted to that.
Jane, thank you so much for joining us. How can we find and follow you?
Yeah, so my website is janecrittenden.co.uk and Instagram is Jane Crittenden Writer. Yeah, those are the places you can find me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Eustacia Rose's life is beginning to return to normal. She is back teaching at UCL and her relationship with Mathilde is blossoming. But when a man is found dead with a needle in his neck, that fragile peace begins to crumble. At an exhibition, Eustacia finds a painting of herself with a syringe next to her neck and discovers that there are other people who seem to know more about killing than they are letting on. The threat around Eustacia only increases as a PhD student begins to stalk and harass her to gain access to her poisonous plant collection. After Eustacia continually refuses, he contacts a lab that is illegally selling synthetic plant toxins, but turns up dead shortly after. As the body count rises, Eustacia has no choice but to investigate the deaths in earnest. But murders aren't the only thing on her mind. Interactions with a new detective have caused tension with Mathilde that Eustacia has no idea how to resolve. What's more, run-ins with a mysterious white-haired woman are making her recall long-buried memories. Eustacia must solve the mysteries of her past and this case if she wants to escape from this toxic situation unscathed. Jill Johnson, welcome to the Brighton Book Club and congratulations on the publication of Hell's Bells, which follows your critically acclaimed debut novel, Devil's Breath. Can you start by telling us a bit about the first book in this series?
Well, firstly, thank you very much for inviting me on. I'm actually a bit of a fan of these podcasts, so this is quite a thing for me. So the first book, Devil's Breath, the first book in the Professor Eustacia Rose mysteries, came from an idea, almost like an image idea. which stemmed from something that I saw in my horticulture degree, like decades ago. And it was a particular plant called a Psychotria alata that has red, its emerging leaves are called bracts. They're red and they turn green. But when they're red, they're shaped like full bright red lips. And it was seeing this plant that made me start thinking about personification and how some people could be represented by plants in a beneficial way and a toxic way. And all of these thoughts were rumbling around in my head. And then it was actually the poison garden at Alnwick, up in Northumberland, that made me realize that I could maybe turn this into a story. Because as I was going around it, I was being told about the gruesome murders that people had done using these plants, and just thought, yeah, this is such a fantastic idea. And if you're going to write about poisonous plants and gruesome murders, then it really should be a crime novel. And then I got so into it that I thought, no, it can't just be one. There's got to be more, and there's got to be this one character who holds the whole series together. And Eustacia Rose started to form from that.
How has it been? Because the reception has been so warm to the first book in the series. It must feel amazing. And I'd love to know a bit more about how you kind of went from idea to actually being a published author.
Well, the reception has been absolutely amazing. And it's funny because people feel like they know Eustacia. I get comments like, I want her in my life. I want her to be my friend. And so it kind of feels like she's taken over and I'm invisible, which is absolutely fine by me. I'm very, very happy to be the invisible person in the background. And I'm just going to let Eustacia do her thing and have her fans. Absolutely amazing reception. So I did the Faber Academy writing course back in 2013, and at the end of that course, back then they had an agent reading day, so we all stood up shaking in our boots and read out what we'd been working on during the course. And I was approached by four agents after that, and I picked one, which is, I know, is like unheard of. People, that just doesn't happen to people, but I feel so lucky that I had that opportunity. So having that agent on board and being signed up to an agency really, really helped me with my journey to publication, really, because I worked on a first draft. I sent it to my agent, who coincidentally was used to be a crime writer's editor. So she was full of brilliant ideas, and she helped me polish the first draft to make it good enough to submit to publishers. And then I just sort of left it to them. I handed it over, huge leap of faith, and they found my publisher for me.
Now would be a great time for us to hear an extract. Jill, please, can you read us some?
Okay, I'm going to read from Hell's Bells. It's actually quite hard to read from a crime novel without giving away any spoilers. So I think I've found a section that is going to be all right. I'd never been to West London, apart from passing through it with father on our countless visits to the science and natural history museums. It was a melting pot of contradictions, wide tree-lined roads with imposing houses right up against tower blocks, designer shops and fine dining restaurants two steps away from market stalls, gleaming Teslas parked next to filthy vans. I stood in front of a tired-looking low-rise block of flats, holding the address Marco had given me, wondering if this was a mistake. It took several rounds of knocking and many more doorbell rings before someone opened the front door, and when he finally did, he greeted me in a stained grey t-shirt that may once have been white, and a pair of baggy boxer shorts the same colour. His hair looked like it had been a while since it had seen a hairbrush, and there was a large wad of sleep in the corner of one eye. He had the appearance of someone who'd been dragged from his bed by his ankles, even though it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I shook my head at the sight of him and ascended the front steps. "I'm here to buy some Psychotria viridis," I said in a conspiratorial whisper.
"You what?"
"I'm here," I began again. "I heard I could buy DMT here."
"Oh, yeah, come in."
He turned and walked along the hallway, and I stepped inside and closed the door behind me. Following him wasn't easy because of the three bikes, the mountain of shoes, the skateboards and the traffic cone, but I finally arrived at the kitchen door as he was filling the kettle.
"I don't want a cup of tea," I said.
"Didn't offer you one." He flicked on the switch and peeled back the lid of a tub of instant noodles, and I looked around the room. Marco was right. It was filthy.
"Does the manufacturing take place in here?" I asked, my nostrils flaring in distaste.
He shrugged, which I took to be an affirmative.
"With what?"
He poured the boiling water over the noodles.
"You what?"
"With what equipment?"
"I don't know. This isn't my side hustle, it's my pal's."
I had no idea what he was talking about, so I tried again.
"Was laboratory equipment used in the manufacturer or simple kitchen utensils?"
He rubbed his eye thoughtfully as if I'd asked him a complicated question, found the wad of sleep, inspected it, and flicked it onto the floor.
"You what?"
What was wrong with the man? Then I knew. He was a poison ivy, a toxicodendron radicans, a highly irritating individual.
"Are you hard of hearing?"
He glanced at me.
"Rude?"
"I beg your pardon?"
"You're rude."
He stirred the noodles with a fork.
"Listen, I've got stuff to do. What do you want to buy?"
I didn't want to buy anything, but I couldn't tell him this. "I'd like to know about the manufacturing process before I part with my money."
"Why?"
"Because..." I wasn't sure what to say.
"Because it's interesting."
He scooped a forkful of noodles into his mouth with a slurp and spoke through them.
"You want to have a go at making this stuff yourself? You won't be able to. It's really complex, really difficult science."
He slurped up another forkful. "So don't even think about stealing the recipe, because you wouldn't be able to cook this shit even if you had it. Now stop wasting my time. Either buy the DMT or leave."
"I'm not sure I want to buy DMT now. I'm still deciding. Can I see what else you have?"
He opened the fridge, revealing rows of small glass bottles packed into the door shelves. There must have been over 100. I couldn't help but gasp at the sight.
"What do you want? Poison? Or do you just want to get high?"
I glanced at him and saw boredom. He quite clearly had no idea what was being stored in his fridge right next to his food. "I've changed my mind. I don't want to buy anything." His eyes narrowed.
"I knew you were a time waster," he said, with a nasty edge into his voice. "I knew it the moment I opened the door."
He threw the empty noodle pot in the general direction of the rubbish bin and added,
"Off you go then, rude time waster."
I sniffed, resisting the urge to throw back a hygiene-related insult of my own. But something about his demeanour had changed. He was no longer the hapless friend who seemed not to truly know what was going on under his nose. He'd become the alpha, jealously guarding his territory and everything within it. He stepped forward, chest first, and I turned for the front door. But as I was negotiating my way past the clutter in the hall, I caught sight of something on the floor next to the wall. Something I thought I recognised. I slowed to study it, but he was right behind me, herding me forward with his body like a security guard.
"Keep moving," he said,
then shoved me aggressively in the small of my back. And almost instinctively, I spun round, grabbed him by a shoulder and an arm, kicked his legs out from under him and threw him to the floor. It wasn't perfect. It wasn't what D.S. Chambers had taught me, and I certainly wasn't going to hang around to celebrate. But in the chaos of the shouting and falling bikes, I bent down, grabbed the item from the floor, and dashed out of the door.
Thank you so much, Jill. That was a lovely extract. So Eustacia is such a unique character. I'd love to know how she kind of came to be formed for you.
Well, she went on a little bit of a journey. So the first version of Devil's Breath was written in third person. And it was divided into four sections, and each section was a different character's point of view. And that was finished, ready to go to the London Book Fair in 2020. And my agent came over. My agent's based in Barcelona, and she came over for the London Book Fair. And the day after she arrived, the book fair was cancelled because of a horrible thing called COVID. But she did manage to do a few meetings in outdoor settings, in parks and things, with a few people. And she sold that version of the book to Czechia. So there is a version of Devil's Breath out there, written in third person and divided into four sections. So after, once we'd got through the pandemic, well, no, it was during the pandemic, my new agent came along, who is the crime writing editor that I mentioned before. And she said, let's play with this a little bit. Let's make it first person and get rid of the four points of view. And we'll just have it all from her point of view. And as I was writing her, I don't know, she just almost on her own, she started to become a little bit quirky. Because she was a botanical toxicology expert and had a very narrow view of the world because she had been homeschooled. She was an only child and had been homeschooled by her father without a mother. So she found it quite difficult to be in social situations anyway. And then that character just kind of developed and developed until she's like on the... I mean, she is neurodivergent, although I don't actually mention that at all in any of the books, and I'm not going to. It's just for the reader to pick up on that. Because obviously it's told from a first person point of view and nobody's going to say it to her face, and she's not going to think it of herself. So it's not mentioned at all. Yeah, so she kind of wrote herself over quite a few years.
So I know that you did a degree in horticulture, Jill. Did it feel really natural for you to kind of bring horticulture and plants and botany into your writing? Can you imagine of not doing it?
It did feel very, very natural. I know the plants. I don't know some of the poisonous plants because we didn't study poisonous plants in my degree. But I'm referring to plants all the way through the book, and it feels very natural to me to do that. In fact, I know plants by their Latin name more by their common name, so I actually was having to Google common names for plants. Yeah, and I don't know, I quite like the books to be very sort of softly educational as well, because plants are so incredibly brilliant that I just want to share that with everybody. So if people read the books and they think, oh, I'm sure there's quite a bit of Googling going on while they're reading, and I'm hoping that that's going to spark some sort of interest in horticulture for the readers. In fact, I think it has with a few people. I've had some comments on social media saying that they've sort of discovered this whole new world of plants that they didn't know anything about, which is brilliant. It's a big win for me.
And what authors inspire you, Jill? Because, you know, is it particularly crime and crazy crime that authors that inspire you, or is it kind of broader?
I think I'm quite unusual in that I've never read a crime novel apart from Agatha Christie. So I have no idea about the crime novel thriller format. And I've spoken to a few people about that, and they just can't quite believe that I've gone into this process of writing a mystery crime series without having ever read one myself. My favorite writer of all time is Iris Murdoch. She's like my idol. And I really love her plain speaking. The way she writes as if she's just speaking really plainly. And it's very down to earth, almost spare writing style that I absolutely love. So she's my inspiration, and I'm nowhere near as like my writing is nothing like hers, but I try and keep my writing really plain and really simple. So there are descriptive passages, but I don't go into the long descriptive flowery like trying to evoke images sort of writing. I'm just telling the story with sections of description that are going to move the story forward rather than taking the reader off into a little lovely cul-de-sac of beautiful writing.
I also love Iris Murdoch, Jill. That's a nice thing we have in common.
Oh, great.
So you are a writer in Brighton, and obviously this is the Brighton Book Club, and I'd love to hear a bit about the community that you are part of in Brighton and how the city influences you and your writing.
Yeah, well, I am actually a Brighton newbie, so I'm still finding my feet here. But I did go along to this absolutely incredible, I've got to big it up, it's really amazing, writing retreat day that somebody called Anna Burt
Oh, it's going to sound like I paid you to say that.
runs. You might not know this, but quite a large chunk of Hell's Bells was written on those days, and there's a writer called Helen Trevorrow, who told me about it, and so I went along without knowing anybody. I just turned up for the first one, and immediately hit it off with the people on my table. And we arranged to go along to some events at the Brighton Book Festival together. That was a couple of years ago, and we still see each other and we still talk to each other, and we do events together, and it's just so they're so encouraging and lovely, lovely people, and I feel really honored actually to that they invited me in.
Oh, that's really nice, Jo. I feel a bit choked up, so I'm gonna move on with the question. What's next in the series, and how is it going?
So I'm just over two-thirds of the way through writing the third Professor Eustacia Rose mystery. It's called Bella Donna. I put a pause in between because it's not one word. And oh gosh, it's so hard. I've got to have the first draft finished by the end of this month, and I've still got about 20,000 words to write, which for some writers they probably think, yeah, that's easy, that's fine. But for me, I'm really slow writer. It's like I have to try and write 1500 words a day every day from now until the end of the month, and it's just so hard. I get to about 300 words and I'm absolutely exhausted, and I have to just sort of keep going, Jill, keep going, you can do it, you can do it. So at the moment, I'm not really enjoying the writing, but I know that once this first draft is done and it goes off to my agent and she'll read it and then come back with her suggestions, which I'm really hoping won't be, you've got to rewrite the whole thing. I'll enjoy the second process of editing it, but getting, oh, it's like pulling teeth writing that first draft. It's so hard.
Thank you for your honesty. Jill, how can we find and follow you and get our hands on a copy of your books?
Well, if you're still on Twitter, I know a lot of people are leaving in droves at the moment, especially bookish people, which is quite sad. I am at writer J Johnson on Twitter. And on Instagram, I'm Jill Johnson Writes. I have a website, jilljohnsonwrites.co.uk. And you can get my books. Well, they're on Amazon. They're in bookshops. Waterstones are being hugely supportive. So, pretty much all of the Waterstones in the country, I think, are carrying both of them. But I mean, of course, go to your independent bookshop, and if they don't have it, please could you ask them to order it? Because we want to support them more than the big, big people.
We absolutely do. Jill, thank you so much for coming on to the Brighton Book Club, and we hope to have you back to talk about the next book in the series.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. And a tick on my bucket list of things I wanted to do.
I am really, really excited about our next guest, Aflo the poet. If you know anything about poetry and the poetry scene in Brighton, you will know about Aflo, who is absolutely prolific. And I'm really looking forward to talking to Aflo about their involvement in the Coasters Queer Festival. Welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Hi, Anna. Thanks so much for having me.
Can you introduce yourself in your own words?
So I am Aflo the poet. I am an artist, activist and academic from Brighton. I got into spoken word about 5.5 years ago, actually, after a New Year's resolution to myself to write a poem and perform a poem one time. And I found the catharsis and healing and the connection and community that came from that just one sharing propelled me into wanting to embed poetry within everything else that I was doing. And then through 2020, I combined poetry more with my activism. And for the last 4 years, I guess, I've been trying to make change in our community through creative expression as a way to kind of engage and empower people. I didn't feel like I had a voice or that I had a way to really create any sort of impact in my life, let alone beyond my personal realm before finding poetry. So it really is something that's changed the way that I see the world and changed the world that I live in.
Aflo, you are huge in Brighton's poetry scene. And self-admittedly, I don't know a huge amount about Brighton's poetry scene. So can you tell us a bit more about what this looks like and, you know, how people could get involved with it if they were interested?
I guess the thing is that it's a scene that has open doors. As much as it may feel like there's gatekeepers in certain places, there's open mics all over the city. Pretty much every night of the week, you can find an open mic somewhere. And within that setting, they'll be encouraging people who want to hear you again and will tell you that. So in terms of what the scene looks like, I guess I can't tell you because I can see it from my perspective, but I know that there's so much that I don't see. But what I would say is that over the last 4 or 5 years, I've seen more nights and communities developing that include people that are more on the margins, I guess. There's more queer open mics, more open micers from the global majority, as opposed to what I was feeling when I first started out in 2019. It felt like, it feels like there's been a lot more seasoning added in the last few years. It's tasty.
Can you read us a couple of your poems, please?
Yeah, of course. I've got one for you. I've chosen this one because in light of the focus that needs to happen on violence against women and girls, I'd like to share this poem. It's called Get the Dirt Under Your Nails. And this piece was commissioned by the Old Market in Hove a few years ago. It's kind of about letting go of gender roles and stereotypes. There's a small mention of violence against women, but I hope you enjoy this one. On this earth, we are taught to tread lightly. With your lips pursed tightly, you should still smell brightly. Step out of the mold and you're told you're unsightly, so sit and bite your tongue, ensure you bite it politely. Some think they're flying free, but still be on string like kite, brainwashed on the daily, so they don't dare to dream at night or fantasize about the times when the feminine divine was not perceived as a threat in any common man's eyes. For centuries, we've believed we needed to be purified, rarely seen as whole, but our bodies still utilised, commodified, then told it's our fault if and when we're brutalised, and if we don't bear children, by default, we're scrutinised. So we stunt our own development as some kind of sentiment, trained to clip our wings as an act of benevolence,
line up with the regiment, too afraid to experiment, and then before you know it, you create your own impediment. A wise woman once told us why birds in cages sing, longing for freedom, a way to cope when living in a reality that strives to deny you of what you're yearning. A life beyond the bars, my dear, of that you are deserving. So break the door off its hinges and don't repent for your sins. And if you can't find the window, then smash through the ceiling. You've got to get outside to find what resides within. Get the grass beneath your toes and get used to that feeling. Get the dirt under your nails, girl. Plow into the sediment. Dig up shrinking violets and unearth your excellence. Remember a time you weren't afraid of the elements. Stop treading like a mouse and roll with the elephants. Head to the sky. Don't be afraid to share your dreams. Burst rain clouds with your crown. Rain down alongside other queens. You're not like other women. It's not the compliment it seems. Leaving a bad taste in the mouth and reeking off misogyny. So bite the apple, Eve. It's sweet and juicy. Tastes like decadence. This garden is for us. It's our duty to set a precedence for future generations marginalized for their gender. To take no take up space and revel in all the splendor of this gift we have been given. No need to second guess it. Plant your toes in the soil, ground yourself in the present. Unfurl amongst the leaves and let them be a lesson. You may lose parts of yourself, but you'll continue on your quest and you'll grow and you'll blossom. Then you'll lose your leaves again. So nourish yourself. Care less about who your flourish offends. We should live our lives with seasons, not dictated by the trends, because we're all made out of stars, but turn to compost in the end. So no more will I tread lightly upon this earth. I'll reacquaint myself with nature as I get to know my worth. I'll bathe in the moonlight and baptize myself in dirt. This ain't my final form, so be prepared for the rebirth.
That is excellent. Thank you so much. I've got chills up my spine, Flo.
Oh, thanks, Hannah.
So you are on the steering group for this year's Coasters Queer Festival, which is happening at the Attenborough Centre for Creative Arts from the 10th to the 13th of October this year. What did you want to bring to the festival?
So I've been involved with and have been watching the Coasters Queer for a few years now. And I guess what I've wanted to bring to it is more local artists and spattering poetry throughout. But yeah, wanting to bring more local poets and local artists on board and, yeah, kind of embedding that poetic nature that's within literature throughout the festival.
Absolutely. You are heading up the open mic and performance evening during the festival. What can you tell us about who you're going to bring?
Well, I kind of don't want to give anything away too much, but there will be a national headline act who they changed my view on gender, how I see myself and how I perceive the world around me, as well as many other artists kind of giving me that gift of being able to see beyond the binary. But this particular artist has a show that has nailed it on the head. They bring me to tears and they bring so much joy to the room. And they bring in other forms of expression alongside poetry. And alongside our national performer will also be a variety of local acts that I've collaborated with at different points over the last couple of years. And there'll also be space for open micers. So if that sounds like something that you would be interested in, I would encourage you to come along and get to showcase your work alongside these incredible artists.
Aflo, what would you say to anyone who kind of has the urge to perform at an open mic or this open mic, but is absolutely terrified?
I would tell them to bring a friend with them and to remember that nervousness is always going to be a part of it. Even the people that you see that are the most established, like top of their game, I guarantee they still feel nerves to some degree, because that's what happens when you care about something. I think it can be so empowering to kind of take those shaky feelings that you're feeling and notice that it's adrenaline because you're getting ready to do something. Your body's getting ready to do something. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't, those nerves don't have to be something that stop us in our tracks. They can be something that propel us into that next big thing that we want to do. And it just gets easier the more you do it. So that first time is always going to be scary, but that is normal. So roll with it. That would be my advice.
So what poets really inspire you? And I'd love to know, for anyone who might not kind of have really engaged with poetry since school, where you think like a really good starting point would be to engage with it, perhaps as an adult.
It's a good question. For me personally, if you'd have asked me in like 2017, beginning of 2018, if I liked poetry, I would have told you no. I'd been to a poetry event. I wasn't really aware of poets beyond people, you know, like Audre Lorde or Maya Angelou or John Agard, kind of like big names that I'd recognise, but I didn't necessarily see it as an art form that I would like to engage in. And then in 2018, I went to see Travis Alabanza, who is an amazing artist, activist, poet, creative in all of their forms. I went to see one of their shows, and they were supported by an amazing local poet, Sabira. And that insight into spoken word changed my opinion. I've loved hip hop and rhyme since I've been tiny. I grew up as a grime kid, so lyrics and talking about your lived experience in a way that is deep, meaningful, it's maybe got a bit of rhythm and rhyme, is something that has always appealed to me. And I just hadn't seen spoken word or poetry shown to me in that way. You know, the poetry I remember from school was very much about war or flowers, and there wasn't that rhythm necessarily that I crave. So thanks to Travis and Sabira, they enlightened me and showed me something that was possible. So I guess in terms of like how you get inspiration for poetry, like there's poets of all kinds out there, but I guess the words that some people may be more familiar with are in songs and lyrics, or even literature and books to some degree. It's maybe to find like a body of writing or a form of writing or verbal expression that you like, and maybe pinpointing what you like about it, because poetry can be formed from anything. So if your vibe is folk music, then think about the mantras and the messages that are shared in that and how you would interpret that through poetry. The great thing about being a poet is that you don't need to know how to play musical instruments or necessarily collaborate with other people in order to bring an idea to life. It's just in you, in your voice box or in your hand. So you can write poetry from anything. You can be inspired by anything. Sorry, that's not a clearer roadmap.
That was such a lovely answer. Thank you so much. So before we love you and leave you, why should people come to The Coast Is Queer?
But why should people come to The Coast Is Queer? You should come to The Coast Is Queer because it's organised by a local group that's been going for a long, long time in The Coast Is Queer and New Writing South. It's so important to spotlight artists that are from more marginalised groups, particularly what we're seeing with trans rights being decimated once again within the Labour Party and politics moreover. It is so important to support these spaces in which these voices and opinions are celebrated, and that we can continue to come together through creative expression in whatever form to challenge these narratives that are dehumanizing and harmful. writing has had the power to challenge and change so much, and there's endless amounts of empowerment and inspiration that can come from this event and all of the wonderful people involved.
Thank you so much. Afle, how can people find and follow you and support your work?
Well, you can find me on social media at aflo.thepoet. That's A-F-L-O, dot the poet. It's like an afro, but with a flow. And how can you support me? Come along to gigs. I've got a zine as well, a poetry zine that you can buy through Feminist Bookshop online. And yeah, coming to The Coast is Queer is also another wonderful way to support me, because it's my first year on the steering group. So it's been wonderful to kind of be involved and have a bit more of an impact on the directions we're going in. I'd love for you to see how it turns out.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Anna. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you for listening. You can find details of all the guests that we had on the show over on our Instagram page at BTM Book Club. If you are a writer or a poet or any sort of creative person in Brighton who enjoys listening to the show and wonders why they haven't been on it, please get in touch. We'd really love to hear from you. You can do that at btnbookclub@gmail.com. Send us your ideas and your pitches and let us know your recommendations. Make sure that you are subscribed to the podcast, and we will be back next month. Pressure.